From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, she persisted.
This is less about political rancor and more about power.
And reaction.
If we don't respect each other, we're going down a very steep path to oblivion.
We'll talk about Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Super Bowl, and more in the Week in Review. Also, Nico Muhly, the 35-year-old renowned composer and featured artist at this year's Boston Conservatory New Music Festival. So there's one more question I want to ask you, and
Tell me.
Like the most basic one that I should have started
What are your influences?
No, why do you love music so much?
What a strange question. What else possibly could I love?
I don't think Nico loves music. I think Nico is music.
That's very kind.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so that means it's time for the Week in Review, beginning with She Persisted.
A person who has exhibited so much hostility to the enforcement of those laws.
The senator is reminded that it is a violation of Rule 19 of the standing rules of the Senate.
Honestly, before this week, who'd heard of Rule 19? But the Senate did take a party line vote and barred Senator Elizabeth Warren from speaking this week after she attempted to read a powerful letter criticizing Jeff Sessions. The letter was from Coretta Scott King. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this in a statement, quote, "She was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless she persisted." Warren says it was the right thing to do.
This is less about political rancor and more about power. This was Mitch McConnell working with Donald Trump to jam a set of nominees down the throats of the United States Senate and the people of the United States of America, to just jam them down our throats.
Well, joining us now to talk about this story and so much more in the Week in Review is John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. Hello, John.
Hello, Meghna.
I will persist, by the way, just FYI.
I figured.
Also with us is Zuri Berry. He's deputy managing editor for news and multimedia at the Boston Herald and co-host of Newsfeed on Boston Herald Radio. Zuri, it's great to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, so give us your first quick thoughts. Did Mitch McConnell inadvertently give Senator Elizabeth Warren a giant gift here?
Yeah, of course he did. And I think we can tell that by the memes that have developed from She Persisted, the T-shirts that are being sold, the fundraising that she is doing off of this incident. I think all in all, I think it was a not very well thought out play on McConnell's part. The Senate Majority Leader obviously was probably tired seeing how that they were going to continue these arguments and commentary on Senator Sessions and his nomination. But nonetheless, it was just a poorly designed hit on Elizabeth Warren that now has turned into a rallying cry for her and her followers.
John?
Well, here's the counter-narrative, and you know, not to get grassy knoll about it, but there is a school of thought that says Mitch McConnell did this absolutely on purpose. And the reason he did it was to make Elizabeth Warren the face of the Democratic Party, push the image of the party further left, because remember, there are 10 Democratic senators up for re-election in 2018 in states that Trump won. The further you move the perception of the Democratic Party to the left, the harder it's going to be for them. So that's a different theory of it.
Okay, so my question then is, in this day and age, what is left and what is right? Because we spoke with Senator Warren on Wednesday, and she had this to say about what she thinks is really going on here.
Evidently, what they seem to think impugning means is just talking about the facts and what happened, what Jeff Sessions' actions have said.
So Zuri Berry, respond to that.
Well, so a couple things here. One, I think there was a his actions activated a number of people in a number of different groups. And so by shutting her down in the middle of reciting the Coretta Scott King speech, or excuse me, letter, that activated a whole group of, say, a black activists and whatnot in their own right. And then there was, of course, very liberal Democrats and those that are backers of Elizabeth Warren. And to go back to the other point about sort of impugning a fellow senator, I mean, this Rule 19 was, I believe, put in place historically because a senator had said something that had sparked a literal fist fight on the Senate floor. And so to him to sort of take that thread and to use it in this particular case sort of sparked a whole nother issue in a whole nother group of people, I would say, the legal activists out there that are very much opposed to sort of how the rules are being changed over time.
John, I mean, just dovetail on what Zuri's saying here, because I was really taken by the fact that Senator Warren just insists, she's like, in her view, Mitch McConnell did not dispute what was in the letter. I mean, that he just didn't want to hear it, even though it's already part of the federal record. It was entered into the federal record in 1986.
Right. And this is totally inconsistent, because not that long ago, Senator Ted Cruz called Mitch McConnell a liar on the Senate floor.
Yeah.
Tom Cotton from Arkansas talked about Harry Reid's cancerous leadership.
Yeah.
They didn't get Rule 19. And then after Elizabeth Warren was kicked out of the Senate, four Democratic senators, male senators, continued to read from the letter. They didn't get Rule 19. So this was tailor-made for the whole resistance in terms of women and the treatment of women by the Trump administration.
Yeah. So the visual of a woman being told it's
right.
time to sit down and you're not allowed to speak at all
and
for the remainder
persisted.
Of the debate. And she persisted.
Nevertheless.
It's a meme.
And she did persist. I mean, she walked right out of the Senate chamber and read the letter to 8 million people on Facebook Live. But I want to get another reaction here that we heard this week. This is from Senator Orrin Hatch. He spoke on the Senate floor on Tuesday, just after Senator Elizabeth Warren was told she could no longer speak.
But I've got to tell you, I listened to her for quite a while, and she didn't have a good thing to say about a fellow senator here. And I frankly don't think that's right. If we don't respect each other, we're going down a very steep path to oblivion.
Can I just ridiculous on a number of levels. But the fact that Senator Hatch believes that she, in the course of providing commentary on a confirmation hearing for Senator Jeff Sessions, has to say something nice at one point or another, I think that's ridiculous. And that's an unfortunate thought process that he's sort of, or political game he's playing there, to sort of say that Democrats have to come up with something nice in order to vet these nominees. And I think it would be the same in the reverse. If a Democratic nominee were to come up, I think that would be ridiculous as well to expect Republicans to have to say something nice. I think they would think that this is a very strange time in which they were being forced to speak in that manner.
And just collateral damage was Senator Cory Booker, who had spoken out very forcefully against Jeff Sessions previously, and people had pointed out,
and testified.
This is really unusual for a senator to testify against a fellow senator. That was seen as sort of an audition for the 2020 field in the presidential race. Elizabeth Warren just effectively moved him to the back of the classroom.
So can we talk about that? Because I think that's a big piece of this. I think there was a lot of which we're talking about Senator Warren, the senator from Colorado, as well as Senator Booker, who have done sort of these major speeches within these confirmation hearings that appear to be more theater than they are actual substance. And that is, I think, of issue as well and possibly spurred along a little bit of this response.
Senator Warren herself, she would say that she does not feel the letter from Coretta Scott King is theater at all. In her mind, it's an example of Jeff Sessions and the potential impact he could have as AG.
I don't think we can look at it in the singular, though. I think we have to look at it over the body of these confirmation hearings, that there were moments in time in which it seemed like, what were you doing at that point in time? Why were you making this statement, so on and so forth? And I'm forgetting the confirmation hearing. There's been so many of them that I've been watching live for the first time. But this has been an ongoing issue where it's sort of like, is this more politics or are you actually vetting this person? And I think that's a question that people have had. that.
And just an indication of how quickly things move at this point. 2 weeks ago, the progressives were all over Elizabeth Warren for voting to confirm
Ben Carson
as Housing and Urban Development Secretary. So things move pretty quickly, and the apparently the public memory is pretty short, at least on the progressive side.
Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here. This is from today, because Senator Warren persists, as is her trademark. She was at it again this morning, really going after President Donald Trump's nominee for the head of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin. She called him the ultimate Wall Street insider.
If Wall Street threatens to blow up the economy again, does anyone seriously expect Mr. Mnuchin to get tough with his old buddies and tell him to knock it off? In fact, you can expect just the opposite.
Okay, so that's Senator Warren today. I wanted to play that because she's still at it. But let's move on to another story that was big in the week's news, and that, of course, is the President's executive order on immigration. Just yesterday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the West Coast upheld a Seattle district court's suspension or temporary suspension of the controversial order. President Trump tweeted almost immediately in response. He went into all caps mode. See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake. That was in response to a court ruling. But this, I'd say, is part of the ongoing battle that he is having, it seeming, with the judiciary, which his own Supreme Court nominee has said is demoralizing. That's according to Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. He spoke to NPR's Steve Inskeep yesterday morning.
He said that these attacks on the judiciary are disheartening and demoralizing. After I pressed him on the topic by raising it and saying that there has to be a public condemnation of this unprecedented, vicious series of personal invective and insult that threaten the independence of the judiciary.
John?
Well, a couple of things. First, Donald Trump didn't say which court he'd see you in.
Just court, that's true.
So it may go up to the Supreme Court. He may ask for the full Ninth District Court to hear it. I think it's even possible to go back to the appeals court and take another bite at the apple there. That's one thing. The other thing is that it's pretty clear that if Donald Trump had not drafted this executive order in such haste and with so little consultation with legal experts, with other people on Capitol Hill, that it may have been perfectly legal and constitutional. And even at this point, if he went back and redrafted it to comport more with the powers that he actually does have, that it could go through and he could have some kind of a ban. But he seems not to want to do that. He seems to want to go and slug it out somewhere in court, which is pretty emblematic of his style, but it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense if he wants actual results.
Zuri?
Two things. One, 5 minutes after getting the news, I don't think he read the 20-something pages or whatever it was right at that point in time. He just got the news that it wasn't going to go through, and of course he said, we're going to continue to press on here. I think we all sort of knew from the get-go that this was probably going to end up in the Supreme Court. Not to say that this couldn't go to the full body in the Ninth Circuit, but I do believe that it's going to end up in the Supreme Court, and we still are in a situation in which it could end up as a 4-4 tie, which would mean it would go back to the appeals court, and of course, at the ninth, and it would stand as the ban the ban being halted. So I think there is an issue there as far as, sort of one, jumping on this and continuing to sort of fight what could possibly be a losing cause on his part, but two, also sort of this continuing to sort of all policy and all sort of the thought process is expressed through Twitter, through this medium, which sometimes does not make you come off in a very good light.
Right.
And that's unfortunate.
Well, we're running down on time here, and I want to switch gears entirely and talk about the winningest winners in the history of winning.
Oh my God.
If I can adopt the president's parlance here, because of course I'm talking about the Pats and their enormous win on Super Bowl 51 on Sunday night. On Tuesday, they had a great parade here in Boston, and my favorite piece of tape of the week comes from Coach Bill Belichick.
Oh, my God.
These players, they've worked harder than any team I've ever coached. They came to work every day, and there were no days off. No days off. No days off. No days off.
that's part of me fears, though, that that chant's going to become like fodder for a contract negotiation someday, sometime soon. But talk to me, guys, the Super Bowl.
Well, no days off except for about half the people who are in the crowd. Right?
Half? I think more than half.
Three quarters, maybe. So as it's been pointed out numerous times on this program, I have been a made Yankee fan in Boston for four decades. So when the score was 28-3, the numbers I was thinking about were 2004. And actually, someone I was watching the game with said, you know, this is pretty much over. And so we made a pinky bet, and I am the proud owner of said pinky, because it just seemed to me that it was the perfect story. And just because they had ESPN tallied it up, they had a 0.2% chance of winning when it was 28-3, and that just seemed perfect. So it was an amazing game and an amazing piece of history. And I feel bad for all the people who went to bed early.
Yeah, I feel bad for the state of Georgia, all Atlantans. It's a typical Atlanta game as far as blowing it. The Patriots, on the other hand, absolutely tremendous win. The fact that they came back from a 25-point deficit is the largest comeback in Super Bowl history. It's the first overtime game in Super Bowl history. I think we all sort of knew as soon as that a fumble occurred by Matt Ryan, the Atlanta quarterback, that momentum was already shifted in that direction. And so it was a wonderful game in that sense. You sort of get the sort of historical perspective that they won, had this huge victory, and it is this historic comeback, and it's on the biggest stage ever. And then you feel like also that there's this sort of overcoming of adversity, which I think speaks well to the team, but also to the fan base. I think the fans sort of appreciated that this is a team that didn't quit and sort of, in Bill Belichick parlance, played full 60 minutes, so to speak.
Yeah, the mental toughness.
Yes.
So we are, you guys can give me a lightning round of hubbubs because we've got 2 minutes left here.
Sure. Sure. Okay.
Go,
so my hubbub is about Boston Herald columnist Howie Carr, who is a proud charter member of the Donald Trump fan club. He has just also become a member of Donald Trump's swanky Florida resort, Mar-a-Lago, which just raised its membership fee, doubled its membership fee to $200,000.
To more than we can afford.
Right. And there's also a $14,000 annual fee. So I'm just hoping, because Howie Carr emceed so many fundraisers for Donald Trump, that I'm hoping he got some kind of a discount.
Okay, it's very, very your hubbub.
It's good to be at the center of power there. So my hubbub is about Newton Mayor Seti Warren. He has been, air quotes, exploring a gubernatorial bid, but he has been making all the rounds. He was at the Women's March. He's been doing a number of political activities. He's obviously got a bunch of cash on hand. Last time it was reported, $90,000. And, you know, he hasn't actually announced. And Jay Gonzalez, the other Democratic challenger, former state budget chief under Deval Patrick, has already jumped into the fray, and it's, you know, he sort of swooped in when Seti Warren was getting a lot of attention. So it's really interesting to see this sort of back end, politicking going on. We're wondering when he's going to jump in officially to sort of make this a interesting primary.
Okay, so my hubbub is a quick one. This is from Mayor Marty Walsh about those darn parking signs.
If we see those signs out there, I'll instruct Public Works to pick up the space saver and throw in the truck. If they're going to be threatening people on wording, and respect each other. Well, I just made that rule up right now. So yeah, I guess
that's how laws are passed in Boston. Apparently, be nice to each other, even in the snow and the parking ban. Everyone,
it's part of the culture.
John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University, a WBR senior news analyst. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Zuri Berry, deputy managing editor for news and multimedia at the Boston Herald. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, both of you. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Time now for the Remembrance Project. Writer Alyssa Eli's look at ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. Today, Eli remembers a pioneer at Harvard Medical School who spoke very little about his accomplishments.
As a Harvard psychiatrist, Dr. Chester Pierce was endlessly interested in extreme environments and resilience. He understood both. In 1947, he was the first African-American to play on an integrated college football team in the South. That University of Virginia game was racially historic, but the Harvard tackle wasn't allowed to sleep in the same hotel as his teammates. Looking into the facets of his professional life was like looking into a prism, refractions bent everywhere. Back in 1970, Dr. Pierce was the first to coin the term microaggression, as common as denim now, to describe the subtle racial put-downs that degrade physical health over a lifetime. Dr. David Henderson is one of many, many young psychiatrists Dr. Pierce mentored.
A classic scenario, he said, like, you got a black man and a white man standing in the elevator. You know, they're both getting off on floor one. The doors open on floor one, and the white man always walks out first. Right? Always walks out first. You can live in America, and you can have these experiences, and you can have them daily, but he still found goodness in people.
Dr. Pierce wasn't a big researcher. He was a big thinker, writing by pen until midnight, then up early the next morning for calisthenics. He seemed to be everywhere. There was his work for NASA, helping to bring American and Russian cultures together on the space station, his consulting to Sesame Street, and the mountain named for him.
Pierce Peak, because his work in Antarctica, studying soldiers in extreme environments, I think he spent 6 months in darkness with them. He's got a mountain named after him in Antarctica. Like, how do you find people? How do you do that? I don't know.
Traveling the world, he helped African countries organize treatment for mental illness in the absence of resources, training, and policy. That led to founding Harvard's Global Psychiatry Program. His thinking about race and resilience was broad and deep, and yet he was astonishingly humble. One night, towards the end of his life, Dr. Pierce met Dave Henderson at a meeting in Boston. Usually he took public transportation home, but when Dr. Henderson offered him a ride, he accepted.
And he said to me, he says, you know, if I only had the energy I had when I was 85, I would be really doing well.
He was 88.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Dr. Chester Pierce, who died in Boston in September. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to introduce you to a composer named Nico Muhly. The Providence-bred phenom is, quite frankly, unlike any composer I've ever met. He arranged part of Paul Simon's last record, worked with Philip Glass, has written two operas, three film scores, a bunch of pop records, a theater score for Broadway revival, and multiple ballet scores. But don't take my word for it. When I asked Boston Conservatory music director and good friend Eric Hewitt to describe Nico, he said this.
Whoa. Nico is certainly an ecstatic and significant part of music history already. Nico is one of the composers on the planet who has an incredible talent and ability to bring together musical influences from all time and have them cohabitate in interesting, beautiful, and expressive ways.
Put another way, Muhly, as The Guardian declared, is one of the most celebrated and sought-after classical composers of the last decade. Does that sound about right, Nico?
Yes, that's very kind. Thank you for that. That does sound about right.
Hang on here for just a second. How old are you?
I am 35 years old.
You are 35 years old, and Eric Hewitt already says that you're one of the most important musical figures on the planet right now.
Well, we sort of grew up together, so, you know, it's...
But at the same time, I think that notwithstanding our personal relationship, that that's true of Nico. I mean, his particular brand of sound, his sort of iconic sonic signature is extremely specific. You can hear three bars of a piece by Nico and you just know it.
Like in this Muhly composition called Etude No. 3, performed by violist Nadia Sirota. It's one of the pieces at the Boston Conservatory's annual New Music Festival where Muhly is this year's featured composer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, I would say there's this kinetic activity played by the viola, but underneath it is a really simple, almost chorale tune of music. It's explicitly intense, so it's just this kind of, you know, first species counterpoint thing. It's not unlike something that you would find in early music, where essentially you have this information at one speed combined with its own information four times as fast.
When I listen to this, I see Nadia at a dance party in church.
And I think, you know, and this is another example of, like, I wrote this piece really, really for her, and it's a thing that she's, it's an etude, so it's a study, right? So it's not meant to be something that she's naturally good at. I mean, it is, it takes advantage of the thing that she's naturally good at, but it's also meant to stretch her a little bit. So the game of this thing is this rhythmic displacement where, again, there's this really steady thing sort of downtown, and she's sort of flitting around where the streets get weird.
So you see, that is Nico Muhly. He's the barely restrained embodiment of the intersection where musical streets get weird. There are the avenues of his Juilliard classical music training, meeting up with the streets peopled by Joni Mitchell and other rock music LPs he picked up in garage sales as a kid. But at the heart of Muhly's musical street map, the long, beautiful boulevards of the religious music of his childhood, when he sang with the Providence Church Boys Choir. You hear it in this piece, Bright Mass with Canons.
So in this particular case, this piece of music was designed for use in church. So in this Agnus Dei, what I was doing is setting up a structure whereby the left side of the choir and the right side of the choir are doing the same material, just displaced. So you have the same material kind of spatially divided. And the reason for that is because when this the Agnus Dei would be sung is when people are milling up to the high altar to take communion. So what happens is that you've been in the main part of the church, and then you walk through this kind of spatial thing. And for me, that's a very visceral memory of being a chorister in Providence, Rhode Island, where, you know, we sang all this Renaissance music. And I feel like once that music gets in your body at a certain age, you can never escape it. And so I've always tried to sort of send myself these little, like, love notes to the pieces that I loved when I was 11 years old or 12 years old. So that's what this is.
Again, Boston Conservatory music director Eric Hewitt.
Nico is at once like a fourth-generation minimalist composer, sort of. He's also invented, in a way, a thing that I like to call neo-Renaissance music. And we've had neoclassical music and we've had neo-Baroque music, but Nico has this particular love for that older, specific kind of music from the 14th, 15th, 16th century that has this flavor.
So I'm still taken by something Eric said earlier about how, Nico, you bring together this music from, let's say, the 15th century and modern minimalism, and you make it work. I mean, was that sort of an evolution in you that brought those two together, or was it just something like you're like, why not?
Let me rephrase it, because I think, you know, one of the frustrating ways about which music is spoken is this idea of styles existing in their own sort of pens, right? Number one, that I find that frustrating. Number two, I mean, for me, it's this idea of a practical emotional relationship to the music that you love. And so, for instance, I don't see any reason why two things can't exist in the same space. And I always think about it in terms of food, actually. I think is a good analogy, where, you know, if you're from Italy but you live in America, you know, the dumb question to ask such a person is, do you call it Italian food or you just call it food? And of course, what you're doing is you're taking your visceral memories of childhood and you're applying it to your life in, you know, Bill Ricka or whatever. So, and it's this, it's that sort of, and it's not fusion, right? It's not like a little like one single baked ziti with like a parsley foam, you know, it's one zito. You're just feeding your family, right? You're making food for nourishment, and you're making food that tells the story of what you love. So for me, you know, it's Anglican church music from the 16th century, and it's that kind of playfulness that you find in Orlando Gibbons, and it's the sort of severity of William Byrd's private Catholicism, blah, 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 combined with the other music that hits me in the kind of downtown place, which is to say the early music of Philip Glass, the early music of Steve Reich. So for me, it's a natural thing to combine.
Why does that early Glass, for example, hit you?
I love music that's fast and slow at the same time. But what's great about certain music is that it feels like that thing of taking a leisurely walk with three crazy dogs running around. And it's like you all get to the same place at the same time, but there's a lot of different kinetic information that's happening.
So, Eric, jump in here, because I am not, by any stretch of the imagination, a music expert. But I imagine, maybe not now, but in generations past, perhaps there were those purists who would say, get rid of the dogs, because I just want to walk.
Well, sure. And as life continues to change and develop around us, so also does the reflection of our human experiences in the art that we make. And so I don't know if it makes much sense here at the beginning of the 20th century to
21st century.
Thank you. You see where my mind is.
Yeah, I was going to say you're stuck in.
I am. Well, and
Krennic.
I'm not so sure that it makes sense for us to lower the energy level of the music that we're making if we intend for that music to actually reflect our human experiences, our daily existence. You know, life's gotten complicated here in modernity. And I love to hear music that addresses the emotional content of the things that we experience every day.
I want to give you my honest emotional reaction when I first heard the pieces, because I was just looking at the program. And I was like, okay. And then I listened to the first piece, the Etude, for example, and I was like, yeah.
Good. That's what we want.
Dance party in church.
Dance
exactly.
party in church, yeah.
Exactly.
Or church party in the club.
Yeah.
Church party in the club sounds good. One of the projects that I'm really interested in, and this is something that I think you sense and that you will sense in the Bright Mass and in other sacred works, is that I have always resisted the sort of prettification of the Old Testament and of the Nativity, because if you're actually in there in the scripture, it's terrifying, right? Everything that's going on is absolutely petrifying for everyone in first century Palestine, and you have this sense of it's not, you know, gentle snowfall and it's not a beautiful harp. It's actually like the heavens like rip open and you have a million voices happening all at the same time. To use the sort of etymologically radical definition, it's awesome.
One of the major influences that I personally hear in a lot of Nico's music that we haven't discussed at all yet is Igor Stravinsky.
Yeah.
And I think that if Nico can frustratingly allow me to label him a neo-Renaissance neo-minimalist with a healthy dosing of like Igor Stravinsky frosting, you're going to hear that Igor Stravinsky frosting in Step Team that you're about to play. Thank you.
I wish people could see how you guys are reacting to hearing this.
Well, this is really fun music to listen to, and it's really fun music to play. It echoes these specific works of Stravinsky's. Mm-hmm. To those of us who know that music as classical musicians, these allusions are obvious. And so it's sort of this incredible conversation between Nico and Stravinsky's ghost.
Yeah.
And they're working aesthetic issues out live for your entertainment.
So there's one more question I want to ask you, and
tell
it's like the most basic one that I should have started
What are your influences?
No, why do you love music so much?
What a strange question. What else possibly could I love?
Nico wakes in the morning, and there's music in his mind, and he has to quiet it to make it go away. Otherwise, it comes back. And when you make music and Nico's in the room, he like physically embodies, especially if it's his music, the music that you're making. So, I mean, I don't think Nico loves music. I think Nico is music.
That's very kind. But I mean, because it's like if you've watched Grandma make something, right? Or you know, I'm obsessed with people who do one thing culinarily. And I live in Chinatown in New York, and there's like the dude who just grills chicken gizzards, and then there's the lady who sits in the window and just pinches dumplings all day, and it's amazing, and it's unteachable, and it's about a fluency that we, as I would say, relatively young musicians, we're still working on it, and we'll probably be working on it for a really long time. But that's a way as you're saying to sort of be music and be participating in this tradition that can stretch back as long as you want.
Yeah, I mean Stone Age.
Yes.
So the first grunts and hums.
Right. The first saxophone concerto.
So okay, I'm not gonna give up here. How do you feel? What do you feel when you're composing, when you're creating music? How does it make you feel?
Well, you know, I'll use the food metaphor, which is to say there's a really practically, I would say, meditative thing about, you know, chopping an onion. And then one click further, there's the way it makes your home smell when a chicken is roasting. There's the way that you feel like you're connecting back to grandma when you're dealing with a mirepoix or making a bechamel or making a classic French sauce. There's a way that you feel like you're extending. There's a way that you're dealing with the fact that a vegan is coming over. There's a way that you're, you know, just kind of it feels like the act of benevolent creation, curation, and just having a good time, and also, you know, making your house smell like chicken.
Well, Eric Hewitt, it is always so great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
My great pleasure.
Well, Nico Muhly, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Nico Muhly is a composer of operas, pop music scores, and chamber and classical works. Eric Hewitt is a conductor, composer, and artistic director of the Boston Conservatory's annual New Music Festival. The Conservatory is celebrating Muhly's music with a series of concerts and classes now through this weekend. We've got more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today and this week. Have a great weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Thank you.